to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we will be talking a little bit about the ongoing war in Syria and have some eyewitness reporting on what is going on there, as well as touching on a whole range of things from the local as well as the international politically here. But before we move on, since January 1st, 2017, the police in the United States have killed, on average, 3 people a day. You were wondering the exact number. Since the start of the year, 123 people have been killed by police. If we kept up this pace roughly for the entire year, the police would kill 1,095 people in 2017, which, interestingly enough, would be fairly close to the 1,092 that were killed by police last year as counted by the Guardians Project, The Counted, following all police murders. And many of these deaths have raised questions about many of these killings that we've seen, sadly, many times before. For instance, in the death of Muhammad Abdul Mahim in Phoenix, he was a transient man at the cops called on him for trying to use the bathroom. Then in the body cam footage, but the police in Phoenix actually released here, Mr. Muhin was wrestled to the ground after he refused to put his dog down. And after being heavily restrained, and you can see some sort of back and forth there on the video, he died during this struggle with the police. And while, of course, they claim everything is okay, the video not only raises serious questions about how the whole thing actually went down, but also one of the officers in the incident, and it turns out, was caught on tape in 2015, stomping a teenage suspect who had already surrendered, knocking out their teeth. 4 months later, though, he was reinstated by the Phoenix police. And there's also a murder that happened just this morning in Los Angeles by the police, where at 12:30 a.m., a man was walking alone on a freeway with a knife. He ran from the police, and when they caught up with him, they shot him. They claim that he came at with them with a knife, but of course, we don't know all the details. But we do know that one officer used a taser, while another used a gun, which you may remember is similar to the Terrence Crutcher situation in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which again raises more questions about lethal force, the way it can or should be used by the police in any sort of situation like this. Also on January 30th, a man was killed by police in Modesto, California. That was the 4th fatal officer-involved shooting in that city since April 2016, mid-sized city. Makes you wonder, as we've seen with a number of other places around the country, could there be something deeper going on in that department? There was also a man shot and killed by police in Arlington, Texas on February 2nd, where police opened fire on him despite there being a toddler and 2 other individuals in the vehicle. And when the vehicle itself was being used and it was being driven around to some degree, you could say maybe used as a weapon. But ultimately, the type of situation where police protocol usually says, do not shoot someone. And I list all of these because it shows not only that the police are killing far too many people, but that the same questions and the same behaviors keep popping up over and over again in killing after killing. Literally, in the time between when I started writing this and finished it, a new report came in of a police murder. That's what took us to 123. Over 1,000 people are killed by the police a year, and yet we now have a government who officially does not believe that's much of a problem. And that also wants to embrace full-on law and order methods of policing in all parts of the nation. So while I said we might be on pace to have roughly the same number of police murders this year as last year, something tells me that the rate of police murder will trend upward as the year goes on. Your boss and the FBI are probably working together to collect your fingerprints. If they aren't already, there's a good chance they will be soon. As reported by The Intercept, private companies and state governments are signing up at a much quicker pace with the FBI's RAPBACK, that's R-A-P, background check program. Now, RAPBACK collects fingerprints and sometimes photos from employers who submit employee information for background checks. Now, normally, they would actually just throw away these sort of the information after they do the background check. But under RAPBACK, they keep it. The reason they claim why is so they can notify employers of any sort of legal infractions the employee has going forward in real time. And that would include arrest and say protests, but also cases that never in fact go to trial or where you are found not guilty. More on that later. Roughly 70% of the new biometric entrants into the FBI's database of 70 million fingerprints appear to be for civil purposes. So in other words, the FBI is building a massive database of the fingerprints of people, the bulk of whom have committed no crime, and storing them forever. It really doesn't take much imagination to see how that is a situation that is ripe for abuse. Also, in particular, given the increased use of biometric data to allow entry into cell phones, among other devices, this could give the FBI the technical capability to get inside the phones of tens of millions of people, more or less, whenever they want, and with oversight difficult or impossible to do. There's also the other issue of incorrect data. The FBI has no real quality control here, and data that comes from the states is often unreliable. One study found that 50% of the arrest records the FBI holds don't actually say what ended up happening in the case. So the FBI could notify your employer that you get arrested for something when the charges were, you got arrested for something, I should say, when the charges were later dropped. Maybe you get a chance to clear your name. Maybe you don't. Maybe they just fire you on the spot because it's an at-will employer and they don't like that you got arrested for something. And imagine, what if that thing was you got arrested at a protest? Maybe it was nonviolent civil disobedience. Maybe you're just a bystander who got swept up in a trap and arrest. Either way, imagine your boss gets notified, decides they don't like that cause, and fires you for taking a part in a demonstration. So both in terms of government overreach and arbitrary bad behavior by bosses look to be dramatically accelerated by this wrap-back program, which the FBI, their big strategy here for how they're going to get it everywhere is to have it inserted into legislation around job-related things as a requirement that states sign up for this. And in fact, they've already succeeded making it a requirement for grants under the Affordable Care Act. And there's some who think that if the Affordable Care Act goes forward, that the federal government will force the ACA money that's coming to states as grants. It would be dependent on them being signed up, these states, as a part of this wrap back background check program. So you add that to the NSA spying and the FBI use of stingrays to listen to your phone calls and track you. Big Brother isn't coming. It's already here. Well, the moratorium on fracking in the state of Maryland is about to expire, but if you are against fracking, don't worry, because it looks like the state of Maryland is just going to ban fracking outright. Last week, a bill was introduced in the Maryland State Senate with almost half of the senators in favor of the bill, and with its chances of passing looking almost certain. Statewide, there are over 50% of voters want fracking banned. Even in western Maryland, where some communities could actually see some economic benefit from fracking, there is, in fact, support for an outright ban on fracking. The state legislature in Maryland also voted last week to override the governor there. His name is Larry Hogan. The veto of a bill expanding the amount of renewable energy utilities in the state must use. Now, utilities in the state of Maryland will have to generate 25% of their energy portfolio from renewable energy. And it's also worth noting that also last week, the Florida state legislature also introduced a bill recently to ban fracking as well. And we are reporting this to you, and we think we will be reporting many things like this as we move forward in the Trump administration, because despite the dire predictions about the impact of President Trump on fighting back against climate change, on the state and local level, new policies promoting sustainability are emerging every single day, and they're pretty popular. And before we close here, a little bit more news about President Trump and some of his recent tweets. Over the weekend, there are some opinion polls that came out. He wasn't looking too hot in some of them. According to CNN, 53% of people did not approve of the job he is doing as the president. 53% also felt that, interesting correlation there, his immigration order temporarily, or at least allegedly, banning people from all over was not correct as well, according to this 53%. Also interesting, 60% of people in the same poll said that they were opposed to one of Trump's most signature proposals, which is building a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. So in some ways, you might think that Trump and many of his policies are relatively unpopular, at least for now. Trump, however, does not agree. He took to Twitter, his favorite mode of communication, this morning and said that any negative polling on him and his policies are, quote unquote, fake news made up by the media to make him look bad. And I mean, yes, anything that's bad It's fake news. And it extends this feud that's been happening really through the campaign, but certainly since Trump has become president, with the media that, while to some degree it does note deficiencies with the mainstream media, seems to primarily just be a stream of lies and half-truths refuting anything that doesn't make him look fantastic at all times. I don't know if there's ever been a president that was as hostile to the news media, but at the very least, there's never been a president this hostile who also has an alternate means of communicating with millions and millions of people. So it seems fairly likely to turn politics even more partisan now, as it seems a part of the White House's whole strategy is to create something of its own reality to insulate its political base from its intense divergence from the so-called pro-working class populist sentiment they were elected to enact. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, an economic movement shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy here now, switching gears to some degree, to be joined by Elizabeth Kucinich. Many of you may know her as the wife of former Congressman Dennis Kucinich. She's also someone who is very deep in the worlds of food policy, sustainability, so many different things. I don't even know 100% where to start, but you were the former director of policy at the Center for Food Safety. You're on the board of the Rodale Institute and also work with organic farmers. So, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
And it's great to have you back. And I wanted to talk about something that recently made some news. And you made a trip some weeks ago here to Syria. I believe you were on the trip as well with Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, was also on that trip. Some of us saw just a little bit about it here in America. But what did you see, or what is some of what you saw? I'm sure you saw a lot. And what do you think people who have only sort of followed the CNN, Washington Post version of Syria may be interested to know?
Great, thank you. Yeah, this actually was my sixth trip over 10 years. So I've got to know Syria quite well over that time. And it really is the most extraordinary country with the most wonderful people. And I think the main thing that is the first way to start this conversation is that there's not a civil war happening in Syria. It's absolutely not a civil war. There may have been a small uprising at the beginning, but that has totally been infiltrated now by extremist groups. And much of the country has been taken over by those groups. And very sadly, our country and others are supporting them. So what we're sold on as a civil war, and oh, tribes have always been like this in the Middle East, always in conflict. No, actually, this has been completely manipulated. Syria is being destroyed systematically, city by city, town by town, dismantled quite literally. Thousands of factories that have been dismantled, the pieces and parts being sold off and transported across the border into Turkey, and goodness knows where they've gone. And so this is not about democracy movement. This is really about the installation of something far more sinister. So being there and being with the people was extraordinary, and be happy to talk more about anything you're interested in.
No, absolutely. And before I ask you anything specific, I just wonder, I mean, when you're on trips like this, do you like encounter Western journalists? I mean, I always wonder, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the CNN. I mean, it almost seems like they're just willing to sort of outsource a lot of their reporting. Are they there and just not reporting it? Are they not there? I mean, I'm always curious why so much of, even just a little bit you just mentioned there, never makes it into these reports.
Yeah. I think that a lot of Western media really takes their sources from different places. You see a lot of reporting that happens from Turkey or from Jordan or from some other country that's, you know, involved in the crisis, but in a very different kind of way. They'd have their press releases that come and they read, and then they put out from again, different sources that are from an ideological bent that they're bent towards. So there's a desire to want to learn about, quote, humanitarian issues. And there's some really, really dire things happening on the ground. But there's also a great deal of fabricated things that are happening as a means of propaganda to support these terrorist groups. And I think that when we think about militants, we think in terms of, oh, just people brandishing weapons and behaving like horrible, violent idiots. But actually, there's an entire orchestrated approach to this. You know, there's a lot of deft communication. There's a lot of smooth and slick relationships that have been developed and forged on many, many different levels. And so we have to be really aware of that. Now, on my last trip a couple of weeks ago, no, I didn't encounter any Western media. I also didn't seek it out. But in trips before, I mean, the last time I was there was in 2013, when there really was a lot of shelling happening in and around Damascus. And there were a lot of media, but, you know, they're in the five-star hotels and they're in their happy, safe zones that aren't that safe, but they're a lot safer than really being out in the middle of the conflict. And then generally getting their news feeds of what they're meant to be saying from somebody, again, who's outside of the country. So you've got your personality inside who's showing I'm here, but the news is actually being generated from across the border somewhere. So we have to really be vigilant about what it is that we're hearing and who we're hearing it from, and then who they're hearing that news from. So I went out this time and, as always, met with a major cross-section of society, from people on the streets that you randomly bump into to, you know, official meetings with heads of the church from all denominations, heads of the Muslim community. We went to Aleppo. We were in East Aleppo, went through all of the sadly destroyed city there, and also went into the western side of the city and met with people who are still living a life that of a regular-ish city that has been under, you know, under conflict, but nevertheless is still vibrant and there. So there's a big cross-section.
And you know, obviously Syrian refugees have been big in the news here in the United States, and certainly we hear a lot about people leaving. But, you know, what is the situation for internally displaced persons in Syria, of which, I mean, I think there's many hundreds of
many.
Thousands.
Oh, many, absolutely. And you know, let's really look at these, at the refugee crisis. People are fleeing from militant-held areas into government-held areas. It's not the other way around.
Right.
You know, they're fleeing from the people that we're arming, and we have to really take note of that. So let's look at the IDP issue. There's an amazing domestic response that's happened, both from local people. Say I was in a camp on the eastern side of Aleppo, where I talked to many young people who are volunteers from the western part of the city, who drove in every day, who tried to help the people in whatever way they could. The Red Crescent were present, the United Nations are present, the government is there. There's a lot of charitable things that are happening. But at the same time, you know, Syria is under economic sanctions, and so there's only so much that the international community want to do or can do because of these kinds of sanctions. So we need to really be addressing that issue. Now, the first time I went to Syria was back in 2006. And that was because Israel and Lebanon had had a fracas, and Israel had dropped an enormous amount of weapons onto the southern part of Lebanon and had destroyed a runway in Beirut Airport. So I had to fly into Damascus in order to get into Lebanon. And that was my entree into really thinking about this issue. Now, while I was in Damascus, I learned how Syria had taken in 2 million Iraqi refugees back in 2006. They were providing healthcare, they were providing education, and had no support from the international community because they're under sanctions. So we see a compounded, our foreign policy and what we've been doing in the Middle East to manipulate some crazy plan. What that is doing, country after country, and destabilizing citizenships, and also, you know, just the general geopolitical issues and situation out there. So they already had taken in millions of refugees, and now there's all these displaced people who are having to be, you know, taken care of and looked after. We're also in Lebanon this trip that has taken in over 1.5 million refugees. And if you think of the of Lebanon, it's not a country the size of the United States. I mean, it's a really small country. It has a population of 3.5 million, and they've taken in 1.5 million additional refugees. It's extraordinary.
Almost half the population. Well, we're going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary. We will be back with Elizabeth Kucinich after this. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are continuing our conversation with Elizabeth Kucinich, who has recently returned from Syria, which is what we were talking about a little bit in our last segment there, and perhaps a little bit more here, and then a little bit more than that as we start to move from the international down the chain of localities, I guess, if you will, to the regional and the local. But, you know, one sort of interesting piece I wanted to ask you about this is, you know, I mean, to what extent, because this has been such a polarizing issue for anti-war sentiment in the United States for a range of different reasons. But I wonder if sort of at this stage in the game, I mean, it almost seems like it's whatever people think about how it started or the way it started or what they think about the Assad regime or whatever, that it's pretty clear right now that this is a proxy war being fueled primarily by us and friends of the United States, and that's the key vector. I mean, could this be an issue that could lead to some revived anti-war sentiment? I know that Representative Gabbard has the Stop Arming Terrorists Act and different pieces like that. Could this be maybe a lever to start talking more about foreign policy issues in the progressive movement?
I hope so. What the establishment in Washington and the country here has really been very clever in doing is taking the policy of a responsibility to protect, so to protect citizens and civilians, and then use that as a cover for going into war. We saw that in Libya, you know, the threat that, oh, Gaddafi's going to do this to his people. He may do it. We have to jump in now. And that wasn't what was actually happening. That was used as a cover to wage war on a country in order to have a, quote, regime change, which then installed militants who filled in the vacuum. What the hell are we doing? And so we need to really be looking at how the media and how many different people within the foreign policy community that have their own agendas are using the heart of the American people in order to gain traction for something which is actually completely antithetical to the premise and the ethics of those people who are then get very confused and end up supporting it. So, you know, this is about spin and media and propaganda and, you know, smoke and mirrors all the time. And, you know, looking at going into Iraq, for example, you know, look at what happened there. It was linked to 9/11. There's absolutely no connections. And yet people get this confusion in their heads and off we go. We're back to the races again.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's a great point. And let me also ask you this, because I think one area that we also don't get a lot of information about that I think leads to some of, you know, the positions people make is the position of President Assad and his regime on moving forward. I mean, sort of the way it's presented here is that, you know, sort of he and the people immediately around him are only interested in maintaining their own power to the exclusion of all other things, which seems to just sort of, to some degree, be belied by the fact that they're involved in all these negotiations around the world with all these different people.
Oh, it sounds so different from our political system, doesn't it?
Right. I know. So crazy that anyone would ever want to, you know, be elected and stay in power in the time they were elected for. But nevertheless, your recent trip there, I mean, what were you able to glean perhaps about ways the Syrian government is looking to ameliorate the conflict?
So, you know, it's interesting because I've been going there for now over a decade, and that was 6 trips. So it's not that I'm there all the time, but it's been interesting to see over that period the shifts. And the one thing about the Syrian people is that there's a real consciousness about being Syrian. It's not a country that's built upon sectarian divides of us versus them inside the borders. That's not the fabric of the country. But that is what we and policies and actually militants from over 100 countries are now fighting there. And, you know, this is now a very manipulated situation. But Syrians are saying, both from the government side and the heads of the opposition and people on the opposition, you know, the opposition is whose voices have actually been quelled quite a lot because they've been killed off, not by the government, but by the militants, because you can't be a moderate within this situation. Right. You're dangerous to the militants who are there really to proselytize a very narrow view of an interpretation of a religious sect. It's not the religion of Islam. It's really a very small sect within that. And if you don't adhere to that, then, you know, you're a danger to their voice that you're conveniently got rid of. And you know, so I talked to a great deal of a number of people who had been, say, in East Aleppo and had, for the last 4 years, had been occupied by militant forces. And they told me in very minute detail about awful things that had happened to them, the rape and the torture, but also when people had tried to leave those areas, how they just were shot because the militants needed a civilian population to be there in order to, you know, do whatever they were doing. On the other side of it, you know, I met with a man who's a minister within the Ministry of Reconciliation within the Syrian government. Now, he's a leader, again, of the opposition within Syria. His son was assassinated, and he was assassinated because he was a moderate. Now, this man is extraordinary, and the work that the ministry is doing is going around village by village, town by town, helping people to get back together again. And I went to a community center in Damascus where women who had lost their husbands on either side of the battle came together and danced. Very, very down to earth, human to human contact to build the humanity back into a situation. You know, we often talk about, you know, trying to win over hearts and minds and win this quote war on terror through bombing countries and regime change. And that's not the way that societies evolve. Societies evolve through people, through human contact, through education, through very much more heartfelt motives and means. And to be able to experience and to learn about all of the different things that are happening on the ground, Syrian driven. You know, when you look at, you've got the international militants coming in and then Syria responding very, very domestically in this very human way to reconcile communities. It's really very powerful and extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. I once met a nun who was working on reconciliation and showed the most amazing slideshow of like going into these free Syrian army places by herself with the white flag of surrender to get in there, and then basically having these conversations about the need for reconciliation among Syrians. And it just sort of seems like it almost seems like that's another piece of what America, but also many other big countries maybe don't see. I mean, everything's about, you know, what is the next set of like 8-party talks doing X, Y, and Z, and then very little change seems to change on the ground. I mean, it seems like this sort of community by community reconciliation really should be the tip of the spear, not just sort of the add-on.
It's very, very practical, and absolutely. And I mean, what you introduced this show talking about, 1,000 people a year being shot by our police force in the United States. You know, that's a terrible situation. We need to be dealing with police community relations issues. We need to be dealing with them at a human community level, not from a policy level, of course, to make sure it doesn't happen. But we need to be able to create those relationships so we can actually learn from methods of peace and reconciliation processes from around the world and bring them back home as well. You know, never before has our situation in America, I think, been quite as fragmented and so manipulated to fragment us as a community into different groups that really are supposedly now warring factions. Now we're using words, but what will it be in the future? And strengthening the government. I mean, the government, quite frankly, now is turning into a regime here in America, and we have a resistance to that. So, you know, there's a lot to learn from different experiences that doesn't come from judgment, but really comes from being open to learning about a real human responses to very, very real issues.
You know, I'm glad you raised that point because it reminds me of something that President Obama said towards the end of his term in one of his final speeches in relationship to Trump being elected. And he said, you know, one thing is that there's a lot of Democrats who live in red states or red areas that don't even talk to their own neighbors about politics. So basically, how can you really be that upset that they voted for someone you think is terrible when you had no sort of dialogue between them? And I mean, I think one of the biggest questions that is facing the progressive community in America is related to this, whether or not there's sort of any situation by which, whether someone be in Congress or whatever, that people should work with Donald Trump. And I think that there's been sort of some feelings that, well, you know, we should pay him back for what he did to Obama, do nothing under no circumstances. There are others who have come out and said, well, I mean, let's look for points of agreement. And if we can get it, we can get it. And it seems to sort of speak to this issue beyond sort of the Trump Democrats in Congress of like what it really means to find points of agreement amongst ourselves across this sort of red state, blue state thing.
So, you know, there's a... We're really doing, I think, internally now what we have been doing internationally. You know, we find a big dragon to want to slay, who's leading a different country, make everything that's evil projected onto them. And we think, if only we could get rid of them, everything would be great. Well, sure enough, you know, leaders have a lot of power. But just because they're in office doesn't mean they are the power. The power is in the people, and that's not being all flaky and hippie. It's with us, you know, every single interaction, every single day. We determine the conversations that we have in our own lives. We determine what we do with our money. We determine what we do with our votes. We haven't elected a dictator, whether he took the election, whether he won it fairly, you know, whatever. He's there right now. How are we going to deal with that? We have to be, in my opinion, very, very strong on policy. We have to know what we stand for, and we have to push what we stand for. And we have to push it with our own integrity and with our own courage in a way that we want to be, would want to be listened to should somebody else be trying to do the same. You know, we have to address people with respect and integrity because that's how we want to be addressed as well. So if we can be strong on policy, clear on our vision, clear on where we want to go, and then be softer on attacking someone else, we actually then might create an opening to have somebody change their mind or to be able to actually engage and start to shift a system. So not to be so manipulated into feeling like we've just elected a god who's all powerful. No, we haven't. Come on. So he's putting out executive orders. Half of them won't stand and the rest of them won't be voted on. And, you know, whatever. Let's really get active and get real here. It's very convenient to switch off and say, this is a problem and I can't do anything about it. But fortunately, people are doing something else. They're waking up. And in a, from a very, you know, very high sort of macro view, one could even say that Trump is doing a great thing for the country because he's helping us to wake up. He's helping us to step into our power. He's helping us to actually engage in a political system that for decades has been going down the drains. And now we can actually start to take our own power and for heaven's sake, get elected, vote for something, help somebody, do something in your community, you know, talk to your neighbor. Don't worry about if they're Republican or if they're, you know, whatever it is you do or don't like. They're a human being and they're your neighbor and they're part of your community. Now let's get real. Now, when Dennis was in Congress and he was there for 16 years, he was always over the other side of the aisle. He was always talking to people. He was building the most extraordinary coalitions and managed to help get a lot of things either stopped or passed, depending on what we were trying to do at the time, because you have this slow drip relationship building, education on something. He would always go to the floor of the House with a big pile of letters to help people understand an issue or briefing papers or whatever it might be. And it wasn't about red, blue, green, yellow, purple. It was really about trying to reach people where they are. And if there is an opinion that somebody holds that you find particularly egregious, talk to them about it in a loving way, in the way that if somebody looks at you and sees maybe you're doing something wrong, you would want them to talk to you with respect. And we can move, you know, maybe we can move the world in that way. And when you look at an international policy, when we see things we don't like, you know, they cut off diplomatic relations, they stop talking to the leaders, they stop communicating. Well, if you have an issue with somebody in your family, okay, if you cut them out, that's not the most healthy thing for your family. You know, you've got to start. We've got to really make it real, but make it real on a policy level now. So take it back to the human experience. Be empathetic and intelligent and move from there.
Well, I think that's it's certainly a good point. And certainly, I think that's something that, you know, it's interesting. I think about Congressman Kucinich. You think about Bernie Sanders, the same thing. A lot of Republicans say very positive things about them, and that to some degree, it was easier to deal with them because you knew where they stood. It wasn't a whole lot of backroom dealing, smoke-filled room kind of stuff. It was like, if we agree, we agree. If we disagree, we disagree. And like, we're going to work on this issue, but not on that issue. And it actually, in some ways, was like a more functional form of governance to have people have strong views than this sort of like, you know, Willow of the Wisp deal where you just never know. I mean, you look at how these Democrats are acting now. You know, one day I can be, you know, 100%, I'm going to destroy all of Trump's nominees. And the next day, you know, I'm voting for one of them for who knows what. But that, it's almost like a fake politics that's not tangible.
So there's the question then, where is one's allegiance lying? Is it with the party or is it with the country? And it has to be with the country. And it can't be about power politics that my side's in power. No, your side's in power. Oh, dear. Mm. You know, it's really got to be about what is best for America. And what's best for America is when we come together and we try to make common sense decisions. And we try to move the country forward to a vision rather than destroy each other because one or other is or isn't in control. And we have to get out of this power dynamics and really into leading a country, because internal fragmentation, be it inside the House in Congress or inside our communities based on some ridiculous notion of team play, is just going to break down the country. And we need to look at being Americans. Well, I clearly have a British accent. I'm here. You know, we have to look at the fabric of the society and what we love about this country. And one of the founding statement of this country, the motto was "E pluribus unum," out of many, one. And that is on the House of Representatives in the ceiling, and it's over a big eagle. And what we like to show is an eagle needs a left and a right wing in order to be able to fly. And so let's come together in that body politic. In the middle of that eagle, there's a body, it has a brain, it has, you know, functioning muscles. And let's look at how we can bring them together and really make this thing work.
Mm, we should do some sort of quiz of Congress people to see how many of them can actually say what that term actually means, not asking one aide or looking at their cell phone. I think that might be an interesting piece. Well, let me ask you this quickly before we have to close here. One of the things overhanging a lot of this, obviously the Middle East, people talk about oil, we're talking about local politics. Raise the thing in with Maryland. I mean, how important do you think from the point of view of climate change and sustainability these sort of local and state level initiatives are to making progress irregardless of the national government?
They're absolutely essential. I mean, really the power, as I've said, is in us, it's in our communities and in our states. And that's that, all of that is open to us, and by getting into that system, we can shift everything. I mean, I work primarily in food policy, though you wouldn't know it necessarily from this conversation. And the reason I work in food policy is because every time when we eat every single day, we're determining dollars, and we're also determining the way that somebody is stewarding the earth. And then that relates to everything: water, air, land, human health. Everything's related to our plate. Well, when we look at energy, everything's related to our home, our business, our immediate environment. If we look at ourselves as agents for change in our own life, if we all are able to do that, the system shifts no matter who's in power.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very good point. You know, seeing Sonny Perdue is going to potentially be the agricultural secretary. I mean, beyond the fact that he's like a huge agribusiness guy, it just says something to me that the least attention of any confirmation hearing is being spent on the Secretary of Agriculture, despite the fact that we all must eat.
Mm-hmm. Well,
crazy.
You've just put our attention onto it now, so.
Yeah, it's former governor of Georgia, too. Sonny Perdue is just, I can't even get started on this guy. He was a big immigrant raid guy, and who even knows. But he's got $250,000 while governor from agribusiness companies, so yeah. That's all.
Well, federal policies are really important, but the most important thing is how we as individuals choose to live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of truth to that, and certainly I think that's what people are afraid of. I mean, with the GMO labeling bills or whatever it may be, that sort of from the bottom up, people are changing the way they get where they get their food, how they want it to be presented to them, how they want it to be cooked, what they want to know about it, and it's sort of to some degree, you know, whatever it may be, once you do it one place, you got to do it another place. You do it in one country, you got to do it in another country. And it just seems like we're starting to have in some proliferation here of citizen-based activism making a difference.
Oh, absolutely. And it's making a really big difference. And, you know, we need to acknowledge that on every single level of the political system. And again, it doesn't matter. It does matter who's in office, of course. But, you know, what the innovation that people in real communities are showing and shifting business models, shifting food systems, shifting health systems, that's where it really is.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That was Elizabeth Kucinich, who, as we mentioned, is just back from Syria, among many other things. So we thank her for joining us here on the show, on By Any Means Necessary, here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We are going to take another break. We are going to come back with more from Mr. Pete Dolak about the economics of the United States here, again, on By Any Means Necessary. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking a little bit about the economy and economic alternatives, and we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Mr. Pete Dolak, an activist and author of It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. And Mr. Dolak, thank you so much for joining the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. My pleasure.
So, you know, I wanted to start here with a little bit of a framing question, sort of reaching back about a week now, and sort of the first jobs report that came out during the Trump administration, even though it sort of measured some things from the end of Obama. But either way, you know, the people were sort of, you know, spinning off that one way or another. But I've always felt one of the biggest issues we have in this country is, you know, everything's based off of in terms of, you know, what most people know about the economy, quarterly reports, monthly reports, the Dow and how high it's gone or whatever, and just these sort of snapshots that are out of context. And so a big issue in terms of how people understand what's going on is they don't really even have the necessary sort of, you know, take two steps back view of the economy in order to sort of place themselves in it. So I wonder what you think about that sort of general idea out the gate here.
I think that's very true. That's a big part of the problem we have in this country, or frankly, any capitalist country, that everything is from the perspective of the capitalist. So what's good for the Wall Street financier, the bond dealer, or the foreign exchange dealer in London, or the industrialist sitting up at the top of in the corporate suites up there in the penthouse, that's the perspective that not just the business press, but the whole corporate mass media has. That's not, of course, what's necessarily good for working people. So, you know, let's say that, you know, there's an increase in economic activity, but all those profits go to the bosses at the top and they go to Wall Street financiers, and working people don't get anything. And, of course, for four decades, stagnating wages is the big story for us working people. So how does that translate into numbers? It translates as, look, the gross domestic product went up 3% this year, and the stock market went up another 300 points this week, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, hey, everything is wonderful. Well, for the folks at the top, yeah, things are pretty good. But for your working people, who none of that is going in your pocket, those are meaningless numbers. So it doesn't, those things are snapshots from a very particular class perspective. They don't actually show at all. In fact, they actually disguise the reality of the economic situation for the average working person out there, and thus the overall economy. So these measures like GDP are obfuscations.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great point. And, you know, it reminds me of, you know, perhaps another issue that I think is a very relevant issue that a lot of people are talking about, and perhaps another area where sort of a full picture view or lack of a full picture view can be affected is, you know, one of the biggest conversations in social movements today is around quote unquote identity politics, you know, so-called issues of whether class or race is primary. And you know, in my view, and I always point that out as really sort of a false dichotomy in some ways. I mean, everyone to some degree is subject to the economy. The question is just sort of how. But nevertheless, we're sort of trapped in this debate sort of on folks to the left of center right now about whether class or some particular form of identity is primary. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm disappointed, I suppose, among other adjectives I could think of, that somehow we've somehow gotten onto this debate. And I agree it's a false choice. The idea of, well, we have to talk about strictly on class and we have to forget about all this other stuff as if, you know, people of color, immigrants, women don't have particular oppressions and they are particularly oppressed in ways that other people necessarily aren't, or the other or going, pulling the stick completely the other way and says, okay, forget this class stuff, you know, that doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is our personal identities. And I don't understand why we're having this kind of conversation. Both these things are operative. You know, we're working people. If you're an employee, you go to work, you work for a boss, you're economically exploited. I mean, that's simply how capitalism works. So, you know, the overwhelming majority of the population are working people and are therefore on a class basis or exploited. On the other hand, we'd have to really close our eyes and hide in a closet somewhere or in a cave somewhere not to see that, you know, people of color are getting shot in the street by the police all the time, that they're oppressed economically, that it comes down on them harder. Women get, what, 80 cents on the dollar that a male worker gets. So women are being oppressed. And then on top of that, of course, you know, women do most of the housework in there, and that's part of the reproduction of capitalism. And that's part of the exploitation of capitalism, is based on all this extra unpaid work in the home that women primarily do. So there's an extra oppression. You have immigrants there, and the bosses try to take advantage of the immigrants and pay them substandard wages, even below minimum wage sometimes, if they're, especially if they may be an undocumented worker. So all of these things all connect to one another. We can hardly stand in isolation from other people, hardly in isolation from other people. So, you know, the male worker and the female worker have to stand together. The white worker and the black worker and the Hispanic worker and the Asian worker and every other worker of color all have to stand together. Our oppression is common on a class basis, but that common class oppression rests on the extra oppression that goes against women, immigrants, people of color, and you know, we all have to understand that all these things, they all work together. So we have to fight all these oppressions together, not separately, and not putting one side to the other. I mean, it's interesting how the women's movement grew in the late 1960s, early 70s. These were women who were very active in the civil rights movement, found sexism within their own left movement, and eventually decided that way we have to create our own separate women's movement and separate ourselves from these sexist men, even if they're men on the left. So there's a thing where they actually took a lesson from what they learned in their activities in the Civil Rights Union. And of course, that was both white women and black women. Black women were very very prominent in the foundation in the early years, and ever since, of course, in women's liberation. So again, all these oppressions all link up. Capitalism is based on conquer and divide. As long as they keep dividing us up, we're going to stay divided against ourselves, and we're just not going to be effective. We can only be effective if we all unite together and understand our common oppressions, but also the extra oppressions that other people, including people who don't necessarily look like us, face, and this all radiates back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, slightly shifting gears here, despite all the talk we've been hearing, you know, really since the election about draining the swamp, it appears that certainly Wall Street, Goldman Sachs in particular, in the driver's seat here as things move forward. You know, you recently, fairly recently wrote a piece called Wall Street Bigger and Badder Than Ever. Talk to us about what you were trying to say there.
Well, I just wanted to demonstrate that the banks are not only bigger, but they're more profitable than ever. The six biggest banks, you know, compositely came up with something like $93 billion in profits. That's just six banks. And the four biggest commercial banks compositely have something on the order of 40 to 45% of all the assets controlled by the entire banking industry, and much larger than they were before the great crash of 2008. So not only is Wall Street not missing a beat, they're getting bigger, and they're getting bigger and badder than ever. And you know, there's no less than six Goldman Sachs executives or ex-executives who are being given positions in high places in the Trump administration, including, of course, the foreclosure king, Mnuchin, who's a former executive at Goldman Sachs and then went on to become the head of One West Bank. I believe that's the name of it. Forgive me if I've got that wrong. I'm trying to remember that off the top of my head. But anyway, here he had a reputation of, you know, not only excessively foreclosing on people, but in particularly going on the most vulnerable people, including going after seniors, where just in California alone, he foreclosed on something like 38,000 people. This is the new Treasury Secretary, assuming that the Democrats don't succeed in blocking him, but then the Democrats are not exactly putting up a big fight right now. So this is like very telling. This is not draining the swamp. This is like pouring more water into the swamp. You know, very, very clearly, it looked like, you know, the two great divides, of course, of capitalism are your industrialists and your financiers. And if Hillary Clinton had won, certainly the policies would have been tilted toward Wall Street as opposed to industrialists. With Donald Trump, I think the expectation was that he was going to tilt more toward the industrialists than the financiers. But clearly the financiers, Wall Street, are not going to be left behind. And, of course, with the stock market rising, that's a pretty good vivid demonstration of them putting their money where their mouth is and thinking that, hey, Donald Trump is going to be really good for us. And so far, they are showing to be correct.
Indeed. Well, you know, one other thing I'm curious about, too, in this regard, I mean, we hear so much as well now, especially about sort of Dodd-Frank, things being rolled back, you know, people wanting to do more in terms of restoring Glass-Steagall. There was the reintroduction of that bill, I think it was about a week and a half ago, by some Democrats. But, I mean, is there any real way to deal with or address these Wall Street excesses in a real way unless banks are taken into some form of public control?
I think ultimately the only solution is for banking and finance to be converted into a public utility where they're publicly owned entities subject to democratic control. I don't think there's any other way around this. We could make nice reforms. Dodd-Frank had some nice reforms. Obviously, some real serious reforms with teeth would be considerably stronger than anything we saw in Dodd-Frank. And, you know, if we were able to get that in, well, you know, a good reform, I'm not one to oppose. Problem is, reforms are always temporary, and the fact is that modern capitalism has become very financialized as living wages are driven ever lower and working conditions for people get worse. People are scrapping more and more to be able to just keep a roof over the head, to be able to eat, never mind, you know, pumping money into the economy for, you know, optional kind of buying. Now, temporarily, this was dealt with by the great inflation of debt, but now people are maxed out on their credit cards. So where is this stuff going to come from? So how are you, in other words, how are you going to keep the profits flowing if people can't buy the stuff that you can make? So there's no sense in expanding your business or pumping out more production if you can't sell what you already don't make. You can't sell what you already make. So you go into financial speculation, and a lot of times speculation can be more profitable than production, at least during periods of stock market bubbles. So more and more money gets shoveled into there. And, of course, this is more money for Wall Street to pay it, and therefore the financial industry gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It's now at a gargantuan size, completely out of scale with any reasonable need. I once, a few years ago, tried to do a little bit of research, and the preliminary indications that came up, if you added up on a daily basis the amount of financial instruments, stocks, bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange, all this stuff, it's so big that it only takes 11 days for the value of an entire year's worth of production for the entire world to be traded in these on financial markets. It has no bearing whatsoever with the real economy. It's just so big it can't be controlled and it can't be stopped. And the dynamics of capitalism are for further and more intensified financialization. So we just simply can't reform our way out of it. We can make reforms. I'm all in favor of reforms. Eventually, they're only going to get taken back. Here we had pretty modest reforms by Dodd-Frank, and already, that's a few years later, there's already a big push to roll them back already and bring us back to where we were in 2008. So banking and finance just simply has to be a public utility. It's going to be state public banks with democratic control, where money is used for, you know, useful social needs, for loans, et cetera, to help for people's retirements. There's no getting around that it simply has, banking has to be socialized. It just cannot be left in private hands.
Mm-hmm. And one, you know, other sort of reform issue that's sort of growing in popularity that I'm curious about your sort of evaluation and thoughts on, and that is universal basic income. Certainly the last year was sort of a bigger, or the year before that, Andy Stern, former SEIU president, puts out a book. It's been a sort of a bigger issue in the beginning part of this year. I know it's been discussed by some of the more, I guess, prominent reformist to the left type of bloggers. But nevertheless, some of your thoughts on, and also many Republicans also promoted UBI as a...
Basic income's an interesting question. In the recent months, it seems to be getting much more attention than I can ever recall. There's a lot of, you know, liberal reformers who are very big advocates for that, see this as a way of kind of underpinning people's income. And on paper, that sounds really nice. I when you first glance at it, it looks good. Hey, you know, a few thousand bucks in my pocket, that's a great idea. Who would be against that? But the problem is we have to look below the surface and understand capitalist dynamics. And when we do that, it turns out it's really not such a good idea after all. So let's say everyone gets $10,000 a year. That's a figure that often gets bandied about. Now, obviously, nobody can live on $10,000 a year, so that's a supplement to your income. So what's your boss going to say next time it's time to for a raise, or when your review is up at the end of the year? The boss is going to say, you know, hey, you're getting $10,000 a year from the government, you don't need this salary, so you know I'm gonna cut your salary, and you'll still be getting just as much, so no problem. So what's going to happen is it's going to wind up being a subsidy to business to cut wages. And what are unions going to do? They're always in a defensive posture, and they're going to wind up, they'll fight it and say, oh no, this is wrong. But what will they wind up doing in practice? They're just going to be negotiating the size of the cut in wages. Maybe they'll cut the wages a little bit less than the bosses would like, but that's about going to be the best thing to do. And the reason that there are right-wingers who are, even Milton Friedman, the godfather of neoliberalism, was in favor of it. So that alone ought to make us stop and pause and say, hey, wait a minute, if Milton Friedman thinks this is a good idea, maybe I ought to rethink this. So why would the right wing be in favor of something like this? And the reason for that is simply it's just a backdoor way to get rid of social services, of welfare programs and social programs of all sorts. In other words, for them, it would be kind of a variety of block grants, which is a particular obsession of the Republican Party in the U.S., where, okay, we'll just get rid of all our programs and we'll just give this big chunk of money and people, you know, can do whatever they want with it. So you'll wind up, instead of having social subsidized social services, you'll wind up getting this little bit of essentially a block grant. It'll just be called a basic income. And all these, you know, public hospitals and welfare programs and unemployment and various other things, they'll all go by the wayside. So what will happen is our wages will get cut, government programs will get cut, and we'll have this nice little subsidy, but it won't really, it'll be less than what we're getting. And, of course, what happens when you're sick and you have tens of thousands of dollars of hospital bills? You can still go to a public hospital and get taken care of, but if the public hospital isn't there anymore, you know, the $5,000 or $10,000 you got as your basic income is only going to be a tiny fraction of what your medical bill is going to be. So you're going to come out way behind on this. So we have to look at this in the terms of capitalist dynamics, how capitalists would react to that, and realize, oh, not such a good idea after all.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have about a minute and a half left, but I wanted to touch real quickly on your book, It's Not Over, and the importance in your mind of looking, sort of reaching back to look forward in terms of the previous socialist experiments of the 20th century.
Well, erasing the past is erasing the present, and if we don't understand where we were, how we got to the present, there's no way we can find a path to the future. So studying of history, not simply for its own sake, rewarding personally as that can be, but studying history to analyze what happened, why the socialist experiments of the 20th century took the terms, the commonalities, the differences, etc., extract what we can out of that, and in the 21st century, maybe we can do it, and hopefully we will do it better way, because, you know, as Rosa Luxemburg said, and it gets quoted, but it's still true, it's barbarism or socialism. That's what our future is. I think we'd much rather see socialism than barbarism. So let's learn from the past. There's plenty to retrieve from it. There was plenty of good there, and we can do it better in the 21st century. So it's history with a purpose. That's the purpose of my book.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. That was Mr. Pete Dolak. The book is It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. Please check that out. Definitely check out all of his writings online. That is going to do it for our time on today's show. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.